From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about some of the obstacles facing homeless people this winter season. Then we celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Table of Elements with a look at how the chart came to be and how it can be used.
The periodic table of the elements can be put to good use, much, much more importantly than memorizing the names and symbols, but knowing what they stand for.
Plus, we learn why after almost 30 years, Milwaukee physical therapist Peter Stathis is returning to his first career, dance.
All of a sudden, I was just like, wait a minute. I used to do this. I was pretty good at this. I could probably do this again. And it was just that thought that just kind of like, okay, let's go see where this ends up, you know?
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The winter holiday season can be a difficult time for people experiencing homelessness. Harsh and frigid weather can mean fewer spaces at local shelters and warming centers, leaving many people vulnerable to the cold. This year in Wisconsin, winter came early, and stalled funding at the state level has left some advocates concerned that local shelters may run out of money later in the season. Joseph Volk is the executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness, and he's been working in this field for more than 30 years. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Winter came on very early this year, very suddenly. When you saw that snow and ice, you know, really collecting outside, what were your biggest concerns regarding homeless people in our area?
You're always concerned about people being outside. In the state of Wisconsin, we know from what's called a point-in-time survey that there's, in terms of single adults, about 5,000 or 6,000 people within the state that are outside. We know from the Department of Public Instruction, which tracks homeless students, that last year in our schools around the state, there were over 18,000 homeless children during the year. So cold weather always means peril for people that don't have a place to stay.
What are some of the biggest challenges that they face, specifically people who are outside?
I mean, the first is obviously staying warm, being able to find a place to sleep. If it's a family, you know, you've got young children. Many families are living in cars, so there's all kinds of hygiene issues, problems of how do children go to school. For those folks that have ever been in the hospital and they look out the window and, like, see the world moving around, doing their thing, and, you know, I'm in here and my life has stopped, kind of. It's kind of what it's like, I think. The rest of the world continues to do whatever they're going to do, go to work, go home, sleep, eat. But for homeless people, it's as if, you know, they're on a whole different planet.
When we're talking about both families and single people, how many beds do we have at shelters in the city?
In Milwaukee, there's approximately 600 beds. We have a central intake, which is our 211 system. And so we're able to track basically need versus the amount of beds that we do have. Historically, in the winter, people are turned away simply because there is no space. That's why, to its credit, Milwaukee has opened up various warming centers. They weren't quite prepared to do it this early, but nevertheless, people that have been following this issue, there's been various news stories about how those warming centers have opened up earlier than normal, which presents all kinds of other problems in terms of all of these agencies' budgets and how they're going to get through the entire winter when they're spending money on the warming centers much sooner than they thought they were going to.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions I had for you. I know that there were some bills regarding funding for organizations that help homeless people in the state that were kind of circulating in the assembly, I believe. Mm. They were supposed to go to the Senate. I know Governor Evers has said he supports these bills. What's happened with them?
Well, this is a two-year effort, actually, led primarily by Republicans to get this funding approved. Wisconsin's way behind other states and our neighboring states in terms of the amount of funding and effort that we put towards this area. So 2 years ago, Governor Walker started the Interagency Council on the Homeless, kind of a task force. They issued a report late in 2018. Out of that report came 8 bills sponsored by the majority leader of the assembly, who was a Republican. Those bills were heard in the assembly, passed back in June, well in time for this winter. Governor Evers has said that he would sign all of these bills. And so all that we needed to happen was to get through the Senate. Those 8 bills were sponsored by 8 Republican senators in the Senate. And nevertheless, we have not been able to get them even on the floor of the Senate. We understand that there's just a few senators, basically Senator Kapenga from Waukesha, Senator Nass, and Senator Craig, who are opposed to the spending. And unfortunately, Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader in the assembly, has refused to put those bills on the floor. And unfortunately now, the Senate won't be meeting again until January. So there's literally $4 million per year that's being held up. Some of those dollars were actually to expand the number of shelter beds throughout the state.
Has there been any explanation from these Senate leaders, from the senators, about why they're holding up these bills?
The only conversation I've had was with Senator Kapenga, who represents much of Waukesha County. He took a trip to Portland, Oregon a few months ago, saw a lot of homeless people on the street with syringes and things of that sort. And he believes that if we put more resources into this area, that we will just draw homeless people to the state and create those kinds of problems.
Portland, Oregon is a very different city than us, of course.
It's warmer, number one.
Yeah, and I guess that would be my question. I don't know a lot of homeless people who have said, oh, being outside in the winter or even being in a city during the winter is a good bet, regardless of the resources they have.
Clearly, if you go to warm weather cities, homelessness is going to be more obvious. It's going to be more in sight than it is in a city like Milwaukee. So I think to compare Milwaukee to Portland is very, very difficult. And the fact that homelessness in the state of Wisconsin is a statewide issue. It's not just Milwaukee-Madison. If you look at the homeless children data, literally every school district in the state has reported that there are some homeless kids in their schools. It's very clear that if the majority leader of the state Senate, Scott Fitzgerald, who is running for Congress, by the way, if he were to put the bills on the floor, they would pass between both of the senators and the Democratic senators, more than enough votes to pass it. Why he's kowtowing to these 3 senators, I don't understand.
Well, as you mentioned, there's about $4 million that are being held up here. Centers had to open a lot earlier than they were anticipating. There's a lot of extra money that goes into that. We don't exactly know how long they'll have to be open during the winter. We can't really forecast that. You know, if we have a winter that is as long as it normally is or longer, what are the issues that we're going to be facing as we start to see that money kind of dissipate?
Well, agencies can't write blank checks. You know, they have a budget. They have to pay staff. They have to have a safe place for volunteers. In fact, the last day of the Senate session a few weeks ago, Democrats, who of course are in the minority, did make a motion to at least put the increase in emergency shelter funds on the floor, thinking that, you know, it's cold out, it's going to get colder, maybe they could at least get those dollars out. Unfortunately, the senators on the Republican side voted en masse to oppose that, including the Republican senator, Alberta Darling, who was the sponsor of that bill. So they seem to be lockstep going somewhere.
When money runs out at these centers, will they have to close? Is that something that they can do?
You need some staff at these warming centers. The shelters tend to be larger. You can't put 100 people, families and kids, in a building and say, see you later. The building has to be heated. There has to be some staff there. So when the dollars are gone, the dollars are gone, and one assumes that they will have to cease operations in some way.
Where do people generally go when they're turned away from these shelters?
Well, you know, Milwaukee did have a tent city under the viaduct for most of the summer. There was over 100 or so people living there. You know, when it's cold, they'll tend to try to find any warm place that they can find, whether it's, you know, heating vents or abandoned buildings and things of that sort. So it makes life very, very difficult when it's cold.
You know, you mentioned the tent city, and there are always different perspectives about the best way to help people who are homeless. And the tent city, I think, really highlighted this. We had some people who were saying, well, we need to deliver goods and services to people who are there. And then we had other people saying, no, we need to clear out people and get them into shelters. Of course, we've just been talking about the many different issues with our shelter system just in general. What are kind of the rationales for both of these perspectives, and how do we deal with this once it gets cold?
Yeah. Well, without getting too much in the weeds, in terms of the tent city, and some of the public officials from the county and the city basically said this in some ways, most of the people in the tent city were what could be called newly homeless, meaning that they didn't meet the federal definition. And that, quite frankly, is where most of the homeless funding comes from that comes into the city. But they didn't meet the federal definition, which is very, very narrow, and you have to have been homeless for a long period of time and those kinds of things. So without that definition, most of the people in the tent city really couldn't be helped. I mean, there was no funding for them. There was no place for them to go. That's why you saw, which was very good, United Way of Greater Milwaukee, Waukesha, putting in some dollars, a lot of private dollars going in there, because even though Milwaukee gets $11 million from the federal government every year to deal with this issue, most of these people wouldn't qualify for that help.
Yeah, there is a pretty narrow definition for chronic homelessness, mm-hmm. which I think includes that you have to have been at least intermittently homeless for about 3 years.
Or continuously homeless for 1 year.
Or continuously homeless for 1 year.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you have chronic mental health issues, mm-hmm. if you have other chronic health issues, disabilities, that can also qualify you, I believe.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of programs that are meant to kind of wrap around our homeless populations. One of them is SNAP, also known as food stamps. And there have been some big changes at the federal level, specifically under the Trump administration, that have made some advocates concerned, certainly. How are homeless people in the city accessing SNAP benefits? And if they're facing a situation where they might not even have a shelter spot, how do they access that?
Well, of course, not having an address is a problem just in and of itself. You can't necessarily go to the Milwaukee County Department of Human Services and say, well, my address is under the viaduct. But even if you're able to overcome those hurdles, the question is, what can you buy? What can you cook? All of those kinds of things. At the other end, because the Trump administration has reduced the access to food stamps, a lot of homeless people are intermittently homeless. They come into the system, they go out. So there's a whole bunch of people that are just living on the edge, right? They're barely able to pay their rent, buy food, those kinds of things. So any reduction in income, many of these people have a job too. So, I mean, if they get sick for a week, they don't have paid sick days in most of their jobs, and they have no income. They're in many cases have to make choices between food and paying their rent. So certainly the Trump administration has not been a help to homeless people.
Inside of that, there was another program sometimes referred to as Obama phones. Other people referred to it as Lifeline. Also faced a lot of cuts. I think there's some confusion as to how these phones are actually used. How are homeless people in general using Lifeline access?
Well, what we want to have homeless people do is to access services and be engaged in services so as to resolve the fact that they don't have a place to stay. And unfortunately, many times they're calling the services. They have to wait on the line. They have to make multiple calls, especially in terms of government-assisted programs. And so literally what you have is a homeless person that may have like 10 minutes left on their phone trying to call the Social Security Administration, the County Department of Human Services, mental health services, being placed on hold, being transferred from place to place, and they're literally holding a phone that is like running out of minutes. You know, not having a phone means not being able to access help.
I know there's no silver bullet here. There's no one thing that has to change to make things better. But as you look to the future, what do you think does need to change?
what really works really good, and it's kind of so simple that we overlook it, is to have affordable, decent housing for people. And in many cases, it's what we call supportive housing, where there's the housing that they can afford, but there's also the supportive services, whether it's case management, mental health services, alcohol and drug abuse services, trauma services. If you can put both of those things together, not only can you move people into housing, but you can actually keep them in housing.
Yeah. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Joseph Folk is the executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness, and he's worked advocating for homeless people for more than 3 decades. You can find more of our coverage on these issues at WUWM.com, which is also where you can donate to our December on-air drive. We're looking for 5 members this hour for Lake Effect. You can donate online or by calling 414-227-3210. If you're listening to us on the WUWM app, all you have to do is click on that big red donate button to support all of our programming, including, of course, Lake Effect. We really can't do it without you. We can't bring you these kinds of stories about your community without your support. So that phone number is 414-227-3210. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give. And thank you so much. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll learn about the creation of the Periodic Table of Elements, which was created 150 years ago. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you know some of the differences and similarities between silver and gold or nitrogen and oxygen, chances are you were paying attention when your teacher taught you about the periodic table of elements. The iconic chart of now 118 elements is celebrating its 150th birthday this year. UW-Madison chemistry professor Bassam Shak-Ashiri has been teaching for about one-third of that time. He says the table came about through a collaboration of a few scientists, but Shak-Ashiri told WUWM's Chuck Quirnbach that Dmitry Mendeleev properly gets much of the credit.
Mendeleev, the Russian chemist, was teaching a course, and he was trying to write his lecture notes and tried to write a book about inorganic chemistry book about chemical behavior of substances, and it came to him that there possibly is a pattern of repeated resemblance of behavior of certain elements. And so that's what he did. He proposed, sometimes, you know, people say he discovered the pattern of similar behavior and arranged the elements according to their atomic weights. Later on, this turned out to be not so correct, but that's how it is in science. We learn the periodic table has the elements arranged according to the atomic number, which is an integer. It's a whole number. That's the number of protons in an atom of that element. So they range from 1, which is element hydrogen, all the way to element 118, which is the total number of elements in the periodic table today.
Was he creating this and the others that certainly contributed to it, were they trying to serve some industry like cannon makers or?
Yeah, human beings, all of us, are naturally curious. We ask questions, all kinds of questions. You know, why is the sky blue? We make observations and try to make sense out of these observations. And that's what science is all about. It's about examining behavior, natural behavior, and trying to describe in words and in language and in symbols what the behavior pattern might be. So it's really the result of curiosity. It was not to serve any other purpose, but curiosity leads to discovery, and discovery leads to application.
What sort of applications took off?
Fabulous applications. when the elements were arranged in this chart in the periodic table, it was easy to see right away that there are missing elements that have not been discovered yet, that have not been identified. So the search was on to find them and to identify them and to characterize them. So that was a very, very important consequence of putting the elements in this organized fashion that we call the periodic table. Later on, when we got to the so-called heavy elements, the elements that have 92 protons or more, uranium, for example, then people started theorizing, making suggestions. Scientists were saying, maybe we can synthesize elements. We can make new elements. And the transuranium elements were synthesized by several people. One group at University of California, Berkeley, led by the scientist Glenn Seaborg, proceeded to make new elements. And Glenn Seaborg proposed that maybe there should be more elements that we don't know about. And other scientists, not only in the United States, but in Russia and elsewhere, undertook serious experimentation that led to identifying some of these synthetic elements. They weren't really discovered. They were made. They were synthesized. And interestingly enough, some of these heavy elements do not have a long lifetime. They disintegrate. They release energy and disintegrate. They get very stable. Some are, their lifetime is in the order of seconds. And that's another consequence of these discoveries, and how to develop the technologies to detect these transformations that are made. So there, it's just a very, very intriguing and very rewarding pursuit. As you can imagine, it's also very challenging, but that's where the rewarding aspect comes in.
And remind me, the synthetic elements, they're on the table too, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're on the table. Yeah, all the elements in the last row that you see near the bottom of the table are synthesized by us. They're, you know, made by groups of scientists, men and women. And that's another aspect that I want to include in this conversation, how these elements are named. Originally, the elements were named, many of them, most of them, after the location, the region where they were isolated and discovered. But with the new synthetic elements, the credit is given to the people who first identify it, and then there's a lot of verification that goes on. There is an international group. It's called the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. This organization has the final say about the naming of an element that a group says they have discovered. Again, I use the word discovered advisedly here, that it's synthesized. But who knows? Maybe in the universe, some of these elements are there too, but their lifetime is very short. But the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry then, after very careful scrutiny, decides finally on the name of the element. And, of course, the element fits in the periodic table according to its own atomic number.
Would you argue this table is still useful today by not just teachers and classrooms?
Of course it's useful. And sometimes the teachers in the classroom don't use it the way it should be used. It's not just to memorize the names and symbols of these elements. It's to think about the patterns of behavior and the way in which the chemical and physical properties of the different substances that we encounter are related to each other. I know in many classrooms, if people say memorize, I used to say in my classroom, memorize the names and symbols of the first 36 elements in the periodic table. It's the first assignment in my freshman chemistry course at UW-Madison. And students would say, well, why do I have to memorize them? And I'd say, because when you talk about the element potassium, you should know that it's represented by the symbol K, not by the symbol P. The symbol P refers to phosphorus. So there are ways by which the periodic table, as an organized means of chemical behavior, can be used instructively to make students aware of the beauty of it. And that's what I advocate, not only in my own teaching, but in workshops that I do with teachers and with others and with the public at large. So the periodic chart of the elements, the periodic table of the elements, can be put to good use, much, much more importantly than memorizing the names and symbols, but knowing what they stand for. It's the identity of the element. Why is potassium symbol K? Why are the elements arranged in columns in the periodic table? What is the pattern of behavior? How is it correlated to the structure of the electrons outside the nucleus? All kinds of beautiful manifestations can be discerned and used properly.
Well, let's explore that example just a little bit more about K, potassium. Is it more related vertically to sodium above it or to calcium to the right of it? In other words, are the groupings more vertically or horizontally or a bit of both?
There are correlations all over the place. That's a very good question, Chuck. So the pattern I was referring to is the vertical pattern. The chemical properties of lithium and sodium and potassium and rubidium and cesium compounds are very similar to each other. There is periodic repetition. This is why it's called periodic table. If there's periodicity in it, the relationship between potassium and calcium, which is right next to it, that's on the horizontal line. What's on the horizontal line is going across the periodic table, where the number of electrons begins to increase as you go from left to right in the table. And you can see that because the atomic number is different. The atomic number goes up, so the number of electrons has to go up. So the beauty of the periodic table is that the elements that are in columns up and down have similar properties, but there are similarities within a group going across too.
Do you ever think about how the images or the popular images of some of these elements have changed over the years? I'm thinking that, for example, lead and phosphorus, these days often seen as pollutants in water and other places. Lithium, which as a kid I didn't know too much about, now we hear about a lot of lithium used in batteries. Is that a good way to look at this table, that the elements change in use and image a lot?
Well, our own awareness changes. And that's, again, going back to what happens in the classroom and what happens also in popularizing the understanding of science. So lithium batteries are very useful to us. Lithium also is used in the medical profession for, you know, a variety of purposes. Lead, yes. On my website, scifund.org, SCIFUN.org, I have a one-page description of the properties of lead. Lead is an insidious substance. So understanding the properties and the usefulness and the hazards is a very important part of what we do in science and what we do in society. So it's very important that we asked the question, why was the lead put in the gasoline in the first place? It was to improve the knocking that the engines were having. It was an anti-knock additive. But then we discovered that it has very bad environmental consequences and health consequences. So the slogan was, let's take the lead out and have other substituents in there. So the periodic table can be put to a lot of good usage, and it's fascinating for all of us to ask the kinds of questions that you are asking here.
Well, nearly my final question is, we're at 118 right now. Are you aware that there might be more added? Are there people trying to synthesize more? Are they all going to be synthetic, or will there be so-called natural ones added?
Well, that was one of the predictions that Glenn Seaborg and his group made, and others too. It's not just one individual, that there may be another set another series of elements whose atomic number is very, very large. Maybe, you know, going all the way to 137 and maybe even higher than that, that would be stable. But they haven't been discovered yet and have not been synthesized yet. That's something for all of us to think about and to enable scientists who are specialists in these areas and give them the support to contemplate and devise experiments and methods and technologies to explore the beautiful, complex world that we live in.
Because that between 118 and 137 might be something that's very valuable, cures a lot of problems, your hope.
Who knows? That's why we do experiments to satisfy our curiosity. And when we make discoveries, it is my sincere hope and wish that we put these discoveries to good use. Once you discover something, you have to make a judgment about putting it to good use. It is my hope and sincere wish that all scientific technological discoveries are put to good use.
That's UWM Madison chemistry professor Bassam Shak Ashiri speaking with WUWM innovation reporter Chuck Quirnbach about the 150th anniversary of the periodic table of elements. And while WUWM might not be quite as old as the periodic table, we are celebrating a pretty special birthday. Milwaukee's NPR turned 55 this year, and we couldn't have done it without support from listeners like you. We are in the middle of our December on-air drive, and we're asking you to call 414-227-3210 to donate. That number is 414-227-3210. We're looking for just 5 members this hour, and you can become one of them if you head to WUWM.com. You can check out some of the other amazing conversations from reporters like Chuck Quirnbach, from many of the interviewers and producers here on Lake Effect, and you can also donate. There's a nice red button at the top of the website. You can't miss it. It says Donate in big letters. And of course, you can call 414-227-3210. We're going to take one last break and then talk with Milwaukee choreographer Peter Stathis about his work. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee native Peter Stathis has worked with some luminaries of modern dance. He began his career in dance at UW Stevens Point and quickly went to New York City to study with people like Lar Lubavitch and Mark Morris. He spent a number of years dancing with the Jose Limon Dance Company as well as Marta Renzi and dancers, and he also worked as a choreographer. But in 1985, he left performance to begin a second career as a physical therapist. He moved back to Milwaukee and began Freedom Physical Therapy Services, which he ran for 3 decades. But the dance never left him, and in 2016, he premiered new work along with some of his older compositions in New York City in an evening called Leaving and Coming Back. This weekend, he'll premiere it in Milwaukee. Stathis came by the studio to talk with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and says it was pure chance he discovered dance at Stevens Point.
I was just watching a class after, you know, a basketball, what do you call that, practice. I was going to say rehearsal. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I think this could help me with this athletic pursuit that I had. And I took the class and I was like, wow, this is interesting. You don't have to have a game or a ball or competition to generate movement. You can actually just move and people might like watching that. And so I just was, that's really what caught my attention, was I didn't need to keep score. It was more of a internal process of learning the technique and challenging yourself that way. And then, you know, if you were lucky enough to get into somebody's dance piece and perform, that was the, you know, icing on the cake. Although that never really interested me that much either. It was more always, what's the process of making this to getting it to showing to other people?
Was it a modern class that you saw that first time?
The first class I took was a ballet class. And then I thought, well, I should take a modern class and see what that's like. And then after that one, I was like, yeah, I'm all in. I quit the basketball team. I just started, you know, taking dance classes.
Of course, it's so physical. And, you know, there are I've seen many things where they've compared the fitness level of dancers to other athletes, and dancers blow people out of the water because of everything that they have to do. And I love the combination of dance and athleticism, you know, the ability to be so in your body to make things. And I have no skill in it. And so I really, really appreciate it when I see it and when I watch people do it, because, you know, I can move through the world as a person, but I can't express myself through movement in that way. And so I'm just wondering if that was also something you discovered as you were exploring this new world.
I was just so in love with, you know, just learning something like this that it probably didn't occur to me until I got on some bigger stages and kind of realized, whoa, I am in a different stratosphere now. And I was somewhat ill-prepared for it because things happened so quickly for me. From the first dance class I took to being in the Jose Limon Dance Company was maybe two and a half years. I had never done any performing, and now I'm on city center stage, you know, in front of 2,500 people. And I had a big learning curve to do on the stage. I was good in rehearsal. The learning curve was really hard on the stage for me.
Interesting. So it was that being in front of an audience?
It was more of am I doing this as best and correctly and perfect as I can? And sometimes, you know, you get caught up in that rather than just going out and doing what you've rehearsed for the last, you know, 2 months. So that was something that took me a long time to learn. Some of my best performances were in malls, you know, funny places like that, because I didn't have so much feeling of pressure or, you know, that feeling you have to present yourself in a certain way that, you know, is grand.
Right, that you have the lights and you have the curtains and you have all of those things, the accoutrement of the theater that, you know, kind of set it apart as a special place.
Right, yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I think I've probably saw you with Jose Limon because I saw in the 80s, a number, it's late 70s, early 80s, you know, the company perform any number of times. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing I probably saw you without realizing that I saw you.
You might have. Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's so interesting. Dance really exploded, it seems, in like the 80s. There was so much that was happening there, people offshoots of this and that, you know, talking back to the original people who had sort of pioneered what was going on. But it seemed, I mean, I hate using the word fertile, but it was. It was like it was a time when so much was being expressed through these companies that have now become iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what a great time to be a part of it.
Yeah, that was a special time. I guess I felt really lucky. I didn't know it would be, but in hindsight and seeing what's happening now, that and the colleagues that I had now then are just, you know, they are iconic people now, you know, and then some of them are passing. You know, Tricia Brown, Paul Taylor, Merce Cunningham, all of these people, you know, are gone. And each one of them had a directive for where they wanted their work and how they wanted it preserved or not. And, you know, kind of moving forward into what is happening, there are not the kind of companies that there used to be. There's not the kind of funding that there used to be. And the kids that are coming out of conservatories and whatever the way they get to dance are not having as many opportunities to be in a company where they actually get paid some kind of living wage, and they make enough weeks of work to collect unemployment. And it's kind of they're running around and, you know, they've got two other jobs and maybe they're freelancing here and freelancing there, but they just don't have that anchor that they used to have where they were like, oh, I'm going to audition for, you know, so-and-so, or I'm going to audition. And if I get in that company, you know, I'll be okay for 8 or 10 months or something like that. Now it's kind of one and done, and that doesn't sit well with me.
Is that why? Did you see the writing on the wall? Is that why you decided to go into physical therapy as kind of a backstop?
Yeah. It's not that I wasn't in a company and I wasn't getting paid. It was more for me. I had been touring a lot for maybe, you know, 6 or 8 years. And, you know, the first three are kind of fun and blah, blah, blah. And then you just kind of get tired of eating out of styrofoam and sleeping in hotel beds and, you know, not being able to sustain any kind of, you know, relationships because you're always on the road, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was looking for something that would keep me in the profession but allow me to have a little bit more stability in terms of, you know, making money. I thought I could do both. I couldn't. At a certain point, I had to make a choice between the two, which was sad, but...
You did, but you also have come back to dance,
yeah,
too, which is one of the reasons why we're talking right now, because there's a performance coming up. And so having the business kind of underneath you almost as a prop, you know, to help you, a foundation maybe, to help you get back into dance, maybe not full time, but where you can marry the two things.
Yeah, the scale is tipping farther toward dance at this point. And so the physical therapy company that I founded was great for me for a long time. It occupied my mind. It allowed me to, you know, raise my family, get my kids through college and things like that. When I decided to move on, I actually was thinking about something else. And all of a sudden, I was just like, wait a minute. I used to do this. I was pretty good at this. I could probably do this again. And it was just that thought that just kind of like, okay, let's go see where this ends up, you know? And when people ask me, you know, like, well, what do you do or what are you going to do next? Or it's like, I do not know half the time. I'm just saying, like, I put one foot in front of the other and then the foot again, and I just kind of keep moving and see what happens.
One of the things that intrigued me about your story, because I love the idea and the fact that it wasn't a direct line. A lot of people have a very clear vision, you know, from the time they were six, they were going to be whatever, mm-hmm, you know, and maybe life threw a few things, curves in there, but, you know, they pretty much stuck to that idea. And you've kind of done this wonderful circuitous, everything's tied together,
mm-hmm,
everything feeds into it, but you haven't been married to one particular path. And to me, that's kind of a life well examined and well lived, I think.
Well,
you know?
Thanks. One of the big opportunities that happened for me was, again, it just came to me, and it came to me through Facebook, where I got a post from a fellow that I had gone to school with at SUNY Purchase, and he was very much a dancing mentor to me. And it just said, hey, you know, I have this workshop for choreographers, blah, blah, blah. You should apply. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to do this. So half the times, or maybe more, things find you rather than you find them.
And if you're open to it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And that, I was like, oh, great, I'm all over this. And so I applied for that. And I didn't get it the first time. I got it the second time. But working with him and being exposed to the 35-plus dancers that he brought into this choreographic workshop really changed things for me. And I had never taken a class in composition or anything. This was the first time I ever watched how this guy's name is Doug Verrone, and everybody should know who that is. So,
he's a wonderful,
yeah,
wonderful choreographer.
And
yeah,
you know, he taught this class to the 10 of us. He does it annually, and you know, we had to make a 10-minute piece, you know, for this to be shown at the end of the summer. And I was lucky enough to work with two really, really good people, and I made a really nice dance that you'll see in Milwaukee.
When you look at the early pieces compared to the more recent things, how do you see your journey as a choreographer?
Well, in the 80s, I could still move pretty well. And so I could be very involved in creating movement, and I'm not so good at it anymore. I'm older. And so I depend upon these dancers to be able to co-create with me. And one of the things I learned from Doug was how to do that so that I can use various devices to help them improvise different kinds of phrases that I can then, you know, patch together in some kind of cohesive manner. I'm starting a new men's quintet. The device I'm using is 1.5-inch rope. And so I'm very excited to see how these people will interact with rope so that we can create movement to make this new men's quintet.
Well, Peter, it has been such a pleasure having you in the studio and having this conversation.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Choreographer and dancer Peter Stathis will premiere his evening of new and old works called Leaving and Coming Back this weekend in Milwaukee at Mitchell Hall on the UWM campus. He spoke with Bonnie North, and there's more information at wuwm.com. We'd like to take just a moment before we end the show today to pay tribute to the former architecture critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Whitney Gould. She passed away over the weekend at the age of 76. Just last month, she joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North for our on-site series at the Pabst Milwaukee Brewery and Taproom to discuss how the brewery district has evolved since redevelopment began. Here's a portion of that conversation.
A lot of these buildings that remain are really beautiful artifacts, mostly Gothic Revival, Romanesque Revival, Cream City brick buildings with a little bit of Chicago pink brick thrown in, mostly built between about 1877 and 1930. And when you remember the old brewery, even in its heyday, it was like coming into a sort of medieval walled city here. It had a character all its own that you don't find in a lot of new developments. So I think there was a lot of sentiment in favor of saving all or part of this complex, but no one quite knew how to do it. And after the brewery closed in 1996, a few years later, there was a proposal by two developers, including a subsidiary of We Energies, to redevelop it. They had a very ambitious $350 million plan to put in retail, residential, businesses, restaurants. It was a huge plan, very innovative in many ways. They were even going to put in a movie theater. Well, it never got off the ground. The Common Council never approved the plans. It involved a lot of demolition. And to make a long story short, then the now late developer, Joe Zilber, and his company eventually bought the entire site, and he was able to do what the previous developers couldn't. And he sort of farmed out individual redevelopment projects to different developers. And the city passed in 2006 what they call a development incentive zone that would provide about $29 million worth of tax incremental financing to help pay for improvements in streets and sewers and lighting and sidewalks and everything. And they wanted to put in a sustainable development that would use a lot of recycled materials, preserve what as much as could be preserved of the old stuff, and to create a really walkable, tight-knit little community for housing, hotels, entertainment. And that's what you really see today. And to me, it is one of the most remarkable transformations.
The word you used to me was dandy. It was a dandy example of how preserving an area can be done while incorporating the new. So I'm hoping you can give us some examples of how that was done and why those two things juxtapose so well together.
It's a really interesting trend. For years in the preservation community, there was the feeling that when you built new buildings in old neighborhoods, that they really sort of had to look like everything that was here before. And the problem with that approach is that nothing is ever going to be as good as the old stuff. We don't have the money or the artisans to do it. And so what we end up is a lot of dumbed down, sort of cheapened, faux old buildings. And it's just one of my pet peeves. It drives me crazy. But anyway, this development here is an example of how you can marry good contemporary architecture to historic preservation and really have a sense of speaking to history. And I think if I, as a contrarian, if I had my way, the new stuff would have been even more adventurous than what came in, but it's still very well done. The new buildings are sensitive in scale and proportions to what's here. They even pick up on some of the colors of the Cream City brick, but they use a lot of modern materials, glass and steel and metal. So you have a sense as you walk through here of a real dialogue between past and present, and you have a sense of a really lively community. It's not a museum, and it's also not a place that was leveled just to put in new development. So I think it sort of shows the example of creative historic preservation combined with good planning. Our city planners, I want to give a nod to. I'm on the City Plan Commission, so I've got a little bias there. But they are really great, dedicated people who have a passion for this city. And they were very patient. Joe Zilber was patient, and they wanted to do it right. And they also put in a lot of little green spaces, not only because they are a beautiful little touch with native plantings, but also because they capture stormwater and prevent it from running into our overloaded sewer system. So it's an example. It may not be perfect, but it's such a wonderful, vibrant example of, again, how you can put together the old and the new and create something quite wonderful.
Whitney Gould was a former architecture critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a member of the City Plan Commission. She passed away this weekend at the age of 76. You can find our full conversation with Gould and historian John Gerda at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.